Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 275, entitled Cuddling Aunt and Munching, Food for Thought. This is a reference to a passage that I've quoted many times from the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk that's published by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the most important domestic Nazi group, the most important American Nazi group, and I've quoted that passage many, many times. We'll get back to that perhaps later in the program. This is being recorded, by the way, on February 11th of the year 2001. We're going to begin by following up on For the Record program number 275, an update on German corporate control over the American media. This number 274, the last program, was titled If Music Be the Food of Love, Munch On, Part 2. That also a reference to the passage from Serpent's Walk that I've quoted many times. By way of underscoring the influence that Nazi music or Nazi-influenced music can have on young people, and this is not applicable directly to the United States, but apropos of For the Record number 274, If Music Be the Food of Love, Munch On, Part 2. And again, this is part of the ongoing series, German Corporate Control Over the American Media, and I consider that arguably the most important work I've ever done. And that's said with all modesty and with no small degree of embarrassment. We're going to turn now to the latest issue of the Searchlight magazine. This is from the Searchlight's issue of February of the year 2001. This is an article by Mina Sodman, S-O-D-M-A-N, of Tum Balalaika in St. Petersburg. This is headlined, Russia, Moscow, a Skinhead Battlefield, and it reads in part as follows. A wave of Nazi violence at concerts in Moscow has left anti-fascist musicians feeling intimidated. Over the past few months, Nazi skinheads have targeted several concerts organized by anti-fascists or featuring bands that have never hidden their anti-fascist position. Events are now routinely attacked and threats of reprisals made against the bands and their fans. Skipping down, Jerry Rubin's club, famous for its anti-fascist leanings, has become a target for the Nazi skins, but it is not the first independent club to be attacked. On February 5th last year, a horde of Nazi skins broke up a concert by the ska-punk bands Distemper from Moscow and Spitfire from St. Petersburg at Moscow's R Club. By the way, no connection between the Russian band here and Spitfire, the tape duplication service. Time permitting, I will tell you about later on in the program. Continuing. Rampaging Nazis attacked the audience, seriously wounding about 15 people, and caused the death of one of their own number. After he died in the hospital, the Nazis kept switching their accusations of who was responsible for the killing from anti-fascists to blacks to Caucasians and back to anti-fascists. Spitfire has since received several threatening emails in which the Nazis have pledged to cause problems at the band's future concerts. And skipping down, when the Nazis showed up at another concert a week later, a special police patrol was watching the venue, and the Nazis were unable to force entry or attack people leaving. This clearly did not deter them because they turned up at another gig soon afterwards with T-shirts emblazoned with the word Nazis. One thug was decked out in a shirt bearing the legend United Colors of Holocaust. They were all thrown out. On November 5th, an anti-fascist concert organized by Moscow Youth Anti-Fascist Action was called off after a large crowd of skinheads who outnumbered the audience broke all the windows of the venue, the Sputnik Cinema, and beat up musicians and guests. The few security staff present had to shoot over the crowd's heads to restore order. The result has been to frighten off musicians who do not want to risk damage to their expensive instruments or be beaten up. A concert planned for November 12th had to be canceled because the organizers could not guarantee proper security for the bands. The concert was intended to celebrate the appearance of the third issue of the Moscow ska-punk anti-fascist fanzine Positive, and would have been a big event with films, sales of anti-fascist tapes, and literature and a wide variety of music. If recent violent events in Moscow prove anything, it is the absolute necessity of united physical anti-fascist resistance by the various youth subcultures. Young anti-fascists in Moscow who do not organize themselves to throw Nazi skins out of their concerts are likely to find themselves in the hospital. Such a basic understanding of anti-fascist self-defense has been sadly lacking in Russia up to now. And that, again, by way of underscoring the potential significance of music to young and or aspiring Nazis or fascists. And again, we're going to get directly back into the series about German corporate control over the American media in a minute. Bear in mind the following. Let's go directly to an article that was sent to me by a listener. This comes from the Daily Telegraph in the United Kingdom. This is from the Daily Telegraph of Thursday, February 8th of the year 2001. This is an article by Toby Helm, H-E-L-M, in Berlin. It's titled, Young Germans See Good Side to Nazis, and this article reads as follows. A poll of young Germans shows that more than a third believe Adolf Hitler's National Socialist government had a good side, unquote. Among those aged 14 to 16 in the former East Germany, 15% thought the Nazi regime had been a good idea. The figures, compiled by a respected polling company for the weekly newspaper Die Woche, will be published in full today, with government statistics showing a 39% rise in violent crimes against foreigners last year. Otto Schily, S-C-H-I-L-Y, the interior minister who has led the fight against right-wing extremism in recent months, said the figures on racist offenses were further cause for concern for his government. In the poll conducted by Forsa, F-O-R-S-A, Germans aged between 14 and 25 were interviewed. Of these, 47% in the former East Germany and 35% in the former West Germany said they believed that Nazism had its good points. Among the 14 to 16 age group in the East, 62% thought Nazism was not all bad, and 15% said it was, overall, a good idea. The sympathy toward the Nazis among Germany's youth was underscored by anti-foreigner feeling. In the East, 46% thought there were too many foreigners in the country. In the West, 40% held this view. The figures are the most worrying to have emerged from any survey since the German government launched a national campaign against neo-Nazis last summer. Last week, a formal request was made to Germany's constitutional court to ban the far-right National Democratic Party. Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder put himself at the forefront of the campaign after a series of violent incidents last summer, including the murder of a Mozambican by skinheads. In an interview with Die Woche, Mr. Schily said the number of acts of hostility, unquote, by far-right sympathizers appeared to be increasing sharply. A total of 13,753 right-wing extremist, xenophobic, and anti-Semitic acts were recorded in the first 11 months of last year, compared with 9,456 in the same period in 1999. The number of violent acts against foreigners was 553, compared with 397. By the way, and for the record, program 267, an update on Eurofascism, as well as in the previous update about Eurofascism, we talked about the drastic underreporting of Nazi violence in the Federal Republic of Germany. Continuing. The rate of violent attacks was particularly shocking in the former East Germany, where only 2% of the country's immigrants live, and which has a total population of just 15 million compared to 67 million in the West. Despite this, half the attacks on foreigners took place there. Mr. Schroeder's government is trying to attract foreigners to Germany to fill a skills gap in the economy. His advisors fear the far right will stop people from coming. While the good points in the poll were not specified, the employment policies of the Third Reich, under which millions of Germans were put to work on projects such as road building, are often cited by today's far right activists as examples of lessons that can be learned from the Nazis. By the way, a lot of people were put to work for the Third Reich, some as slaves. Others were kicked out of their jobs because of either their religion, being Jewish, or ethnicity, or political affiliation. I would note that Jörg Haider, the so-called yuppie fascist, whose Freedom Party is the dominant element in the Austrian coalition government at the moment, and who has been a major focal point of many For the Record broadcasts, has, among other things, praised the employment policies of the Third Reich. So the young people here are getting this sort of thing from people who are considerably older than they are. Bear in mind now the book Serpent's Walk that we spoke about earlier, and bear in mind the passages that I'm about to read. I have read these before. Serpent's Walk is authored by someone who writes under the nom de plume of Randolph D. Calverhall. It's about the descendants of the SS going underground, building up their economic muscle, and taking over the United States in the mid-21st century. discussing the SS Economic Organization's purchasing of American media voices. The book writes as follows, describing a conversation between two of the Nazi faithful named Lessing and Wrench. And Wrench tells Lessing, "About 10 years ago, we swung a merger, a takeover, and got voting control of a super corporation that runs a small but significant chunk of the American media. Not openly with bands and trumpets or swastikas flying, but quietly. One huge corporation cuddling up to another one and gently munching it up like a great gubbing amoeba. Since then, we've been replacing executives, pushing somebody out here, bringing somebody else in there. We've swung program content around too, not much, but a little so it won't show. We've cut down on nasty Nazi movies, good guys in white hats and bad guys in black SS hats, lovable Jews versus fiendish Germans, and we have media psychologists, ad agencies, and behavior modification specialists working on image changes." And skipping down, Les encounters, "Hard to get people to love death camps," and Wrench then answers, "We don't try. You can't erase 100 years of lying propaganda overnight. We play those aspects down and stress the positive ones instead. The mystique, the scientific approach to racial genetics, the efficiency in organization, the dedication, and the heroism. People will buy that." And skipping down, "But the gas chambers, the Holocaust." Wrench held out his hands, palms up. "What gas chambers? Show me one piece of real evidence." And skipping down again, "All we ever hear about are the poor innocent Jews and the awful Holocaust, when in fact, there never was an extermination policy, a final solution, or anything like it." And note in particular, it says you can't erase 100 years of lying propaganda overnight. We play those aspects down, assuming that the Nazi crimes were lying propaganda, which of course they weren't. We play those aspects down and stress the positive ones instead. And note again that now a lot of young Germans are apparently of the opinion that there were some good aspects to the Nazi regime. And I would add that they're not in any way alone. I'm sure that that may very well be the case among young Americans as well. Just bear in mind the Serpent's Walk scenario. And turning to the present and quote, nonfiction. Again, I think the book Serpent's Walk, put out by the same publisher that puts out the Turner Diaries, is in fact far more than the novel it purports to be. I believe that it's a blueprint, a manifesto, and a design for what the worldwide Nazi underground plans to do. The following article was published in the New York Times of February 8th of the year 2001. This is a New York Times article. It's headlined, "Book on Holocaust as a Shakedown Starts German Storm." Note who publishes this, and note also the spin on the Holocaust that this book has. "The publication of a book here today by an American historian declaring that the Holocaust has become a, quote, extortion racket, unquote, through which some Jews blackmail Germany has ignited a stormy debate. A television documentary on the author, Norman Finkelstein, that was to have been carried on Monday was canceled at the last moment, and newspapers have been full of virulent discussion over whether the book is a breath of fresh air," unquote, as one has put it, "or a dangerous invitation to anti-Semitism." Quote, "Germany is right to reject the use of the Holocaust as a weapon for political and economic gain," unquote, Mr. Finkelstein said at a packed news conference, again quoting, "The Holocaust has long since ceased to be a source of moral and historical enlightenment. It has become a straight-out extortion racket," unquote. Later on in the broadcast, in the, probably the second side of the program, we're going to examine whether perhaps there's an extortion racket going in the other direction. Continuing, "The author, whose parents were Holocaust survivors, was presenting the German translation of his book, The Holocaust Industry, published last year in the United States, to a generally hostile reception. It was also published in Britain. Its central argument is that what he calls an American Jewish elite," unquote, "has appropriated the Holocaust and debased it for financial gain. The book's publication here comes at a particularly sensitive time. Long negotiations that culminated last year with an agreement for the German government to pay $4.8 billion to people coerced into working for the Nazis revealed growing impatience here with such quests for compensation. Germany has also suffered a wave of anti-Semitic and xenophobic attacks over the past year. In this context, Piper Verlag, the publisher of Mr. Finkelstein's book, came under pressure to refrain from publication. Ignoring the pressure and sensing a commercial success, Piper Verlag has published 50,000 copies, a large initial printing. It has come to the accompaniment of bitter criticism from leading German historians. First of all, note that Piper Verlag is owned by, surprise, surprise, Bertelsmann, the firm which has been the focal point of so much of the discussion in this series. Bertelsmann is the third largest media conglomerate in the world, has effective control over American and English language publishing in terms of books, trade publishing, that is, and they are moving up in other aspects of media control, including and especially music, as we looked at in the last installment in this series for the record program number 274. With regard to Mr. Finkelstein, first of all, there are plenty of Jewish fascists. The Bormann Group utilizes Jews specifically, so his Jewish name and Jewish religion is not necessarily terribly significant. The Likud party and the Israeli right wing has very strong grounding in international fascism, as I've looked at in a number of different broadcasts available from Spitfire. And I would also note again that the Bormann organization has specifically utilized Jews. I would also note that anybody can convert to the religion and change their name, and the changing of documents was very, very easy indeed for the Third Reich as it prepared to go underground. None other than Reichsleiter Martin Bormann himself posed as Eliezer Goldstein during his international flight to make it to Latin America. But note also the subtle revision of history here, not unlike the changing of the content that was discussed in Serpent's Walk. Notice that the American Jewish elite here, very much reminiscent of the Third Reich's rhetoric, is discussed as having appropriated the Holocaust. And note also that the lawsuits are being discussed as a straight-out extortion racket, which is a rather interesting spin on this. I would note that people who were forced to work as slave laborers in the Nazi labor camps are among the groups that are suing for compensation. That will be discussed later on in the program. Note also young Germans' admiration for the employment policies of the Third Reich. It's an example of be careful what you wish for, you might get it. I would also note that major corporations, including and especially American corporations, American-based transnationals, bear a significant share of the moral and political guilt of the Third Reich, as I've noted in many past broadcasts. I do think that it is interesting that the lawsuits that have been filed have been delayed for so many years. A lot of the people who could have been received compensation have died. I think the end of the Cold War has a great deal to do with the timing. I will note, however, that yours truly was among the very first people to, at least in the post-World War II period, to discuss this on the electronic media, that is to say, American-based transnationals, and their absolutely pivotal influence within the Third Reich. So do note that. Note also that one Norman Finkelstein, an alleged Holocaust survivor, perhaps are the son of an alleged Holocaust survivor, is now publishing with Piper Verlag, a division of Bertelsmann, talking about the American Jewish elite and the Holocaust as an extortion racket, an interesting spin on history. Note also that Bertelsmann in this past week, again, the largest supplier of books to the Wehrmacht, a supplier of books for the SS, one of the financiers of the Himmler Kreis, the Himmler Circle of Friends that finance the day-to-day operations, and run by the patriarch, Heinrich Mohn, who was himself SS, that he basically shepherded the company into the post-war period. Note that Bertelsmann has made a very, very significant venture in the past week. They have conducted a transaction with a Belgian firm, which in turn is controlled by a Luxembourg-based holding company, as we looked at in earlier discussions of this company. And this particular company, Audiofina of Belgium, is inextricably linked with Bertelsmann's TV deals. And this basically this very complex transaction was accomplished through equity. Basically, Bertelsmann is now in a position to begin going public. This will give them a tremendous amount of capital in order to expand their control, but yet as we will see in the article to follow, the control is going to remain with the Bertelsmann firm and the Mohn family. The Wall Street Journal of February 5th of 2001 discussed this particular purchase. This is an article by Charles Goldsmith of the Wall Street Journal headlined, Bertelsmann Moves to Gain Control of Broadcaster RTL. And the article reads, Germany's Bertelsmann AG is set to acquire control of pan-European broadcaster RTL Group PLC through a transaction with Group Bruxelles-Lambert of Belgium, say people familiar with the matter. Bertelsmann currently holds about 37% of RTL Group, while GBL owns about 30%. Pearson PLC of Britain has about 22%, and about 11% is traded freely. Under the deal expected to be announced today, Bertelsmann would acquire GBL's 30% stake, say people familiar with the developments, while GBL would receive a significant interest in Bertelsmann. It wasn't clear exactly what form GBL's interest in the German company would take, given that Bertelsmann isn't a publicly traded company. However, Bertelsmann's chairman and chief executive, Thomas Middelhoff, has been seeking access to capital markets through bond issues and by listing subsidiaries below the group level. A deal with GBL, which is listed on the Brussels exchange, could be a way to achieve that goal. Note the following sentence. For Bertelsmann, gaining control of RTL is in line with its strategy of controlling the businesses in which it is involved. RTL was formed last April by combining the CLT-UTA broadcasting interests of Bertelsmann with Audiofina of Belgium, part of GBL, and Pearson Television of Britain. At the time RTL Group was formed, it was valued at £15 billion, or $22.18 billion. RTL's primary listing will remain in London, and its secondary listing will stay in Luxembourg, these people say. A Bertelsmann spokesman declined to comment. And note, repeating this one sentence, for Bertelsmann, gaining control of RTL is in line with its strategy of controlling the businesses in which it is involved. Note that the secondary listing is with a Luxembourg-based holding company, as we looked at in discussions of this particular transaction with Audiofina in past installments of this particular series, Luxembourg-based holding companies being a major element in the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization. Now, the significance of this particular deal is discussed in some analysis of this particular transaction in the Financial Times of Tuesday, February 6th of the year 2001. This is an analysis by James Harding. It's headlined, Bertelsmann Puts Its Faith in the Market. Subtitled, The German Media Group's Latest Deal Gives Some Idea of Its Valuation, and the article reads in part as follows. Just over 2 years ago, Thomas Middelhoff sent a memo to 4,000 senior executives at Bertelsmann, the privately owned media group. Quote, The faster we get, the better. We must act as though we actually are a publicly listed company, unquote, wrote Bertelsmann's then 46-year-old chief executive. Yesterday, Mr. Middelhoff took the message to his troops a significant stage further. Instead of acting like a public company, the world's fifth-largest media group by revenues behind rivals such as News Corp and AOL Time Warner is poised to become one. As part of a complex asset swap, Bertelsmann has readied itself for an initial public offering in 3 to 4 years. In return for control of RTL, the pan-European broadcaster, 25% of Bertelsmann is being given to Group Bruxelles-Lambert, which can list the stake from 2004 onward. And skipping down, the fact that Bertelsmann, which has cash reserves of 30 billion Deutschmarks, chose to acquire the RTL stake with equity, perhaps it helps to explain what one analyst calls the baffling price. Quote, Middelhoff's real game is getting to market, unquote, he says. And skipping down, here's the real significance of the transaction. It is hardly surprising that Bertelsmann's chief executive describes the company as, quote, busy, unquote. There are two more large deals under discussion, he says. More munching up, I would add. The company is on the road to partial public ownership. Even before then, more changes are likely. We started this process 3 years ago, and we are going step by step from deal to deal, he says. For many of those inside Bertelsmann, Mr. Middelhoff's most surprising achievement is to persuade Mr. Mohn to allow Bertelsmann to become a public company. But Mr. Middelhoff insists that the changed ownership status will not undermine its culture, since the Mohn family and Bertelsmann Foundation will still control the company. Basically, to make a long story short, and I can realize that some of these transactions are very complex to understand, effective corporate control is going to remain with the Bertelsmann firm, but by exchanging equity, in other words, ownership of their stock, in order to go public, this is going to drastically expand Bertelsmann's capital assets and enable them to take over other companies. In other words, more cuddling up and more gentle, or perhaps not so gentle, munching. What we're going to do now is to anticipate a broadcast specifically for the Record Program 193 about the CDU funding scandal, and we're going to anticipate an update coming up probably next week with regard to the CDU funding scandal. This also is from the Financial Times of Tuesday, February 6th of the year 2001. This is an article by Dan Bilefsky in Brussels, that's Bilefsky. It's headlined, Global GBL Falls for Bertelsmann's Charms, and this reads in part as follows. For Groupe Bruxelles-Lambert, the Belgian holding company controlled by billionaire Albert Frère, swapping its stake in Europe's largest TV group for a share in Bertelsmann reflects a love affair with global companies. And again, the real significance of this I already outlined. Bertelsmann's going to remain in control, but in exchange for going public, this is going to drastically expand Bertelsmann's capital and enable them to take over other companies. Skipping down, note one of the capital investments of Mr. Frère. GBL, which is jointly controlled with Paul Desmarais, the French-Canadian head of Power Corporation, has often used its Belgian assets to invest in groups such as French oil giant Totalfina ELF and French utility Suez-Lyonnais des Eaux. Note Totalfina ELF, that's the French oil giant which was at the very center of one of the major aspects of the CDU funding scandal, and we'll talk about that in an update. I've alluded to other programs in this series. Those are available from a tape duplication called Spitfire. That's Spitfire. Their mailing address is P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. You can visit the Real Audio Equipped website of Spitfire at www.spitfirelist.com. That's Spitfirelist.com. And there are also archived, Real Audio archived files of these programs on the website of WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. You can access those Real Audio archives at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, DaveEmory. There is a detailed and annotated description of For the Record program number 275 that will be available when this program goes up on the Spitfire website. You can examine that in the For the Record section at spitfirelist.com. That concludes For the Record program number 275, Side A, Cuddling and Munching, Food for Thought, an update on German corporate control over the American media. This is being recorded on February 11th of 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening, and good night, or actually good day.